This is WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm, music for open ears. This is the newest monthly installment of Reading is Funkdemental. My name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician. I play in a band called Spaghetti Eastern Music and several others. And I also write about music for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Pop Matters, and some local press too. And I am here today to talk all about King Crimson with the man who knows more about King Crimson than anyone, more than Robert Fripp, I would say. His name is Sid Smith. He's the author of a fabulous book that came out in 2001, firstly, and then was updated in 2019 for the 50th anniversary of this massive band. It is called In the Court of King Crimson, an observation over 50 years. We just listened to a little King Crimson coming in, 20th Century Schizoid Man, and something by myself, Spaghetti Eastern Music, which is inspired by Robert Fripp. It was a sort of Frippertronics thing, a score for a dance piece called 2x2x4. Without further ado, let's talk about all thing King Crimson with the man who knows more than Robert Fripp about King Crimson, I think, Sid Smith. Okay, well, welcome, Sid Smith, to Reading is Funkdemental. First thing I want to do is I want to hear a little bit about yourself, your writing history. You are sort of the prog father, if you will, writing not only many articles, but liner notes, and then a little bit about your actual association with Fripp and company. So let's hear a little bit about your.
So a potted history. First of all, thanks for inviting me onto the show. It feels really strange. Normally, I'm used to interviewing people. I never get in. So it's kind of a novelty. But what I'm prepared to go with. So I guess. The quick version is I've been kind of writing professionally for, I don't know, about 25 years, something like that. And when I say writing professionally, I just mean, you know, I don't do anything else to earn a living. And remarkably, over that period of time, I've said this before, it's such a novelty. I still find it, 25 years later, I still find it real, such a novelty when people pay me real money to write about music. It's mad in this day and age, especially with so many public print publications that are no more and what have you. So the fact that Prog Magazine here in the UK keep inviting me to write articles for them, I'm really grateful. It's lovely. There's nothing better, I think, than sort of sitting in the comfort of your own office writing about albums that you love.
Yes,
it's a great job, and it's particularly nice when you get asked to write about albums that you loved as a kid, as a teenager. And of course, you and I both know that those albums that we hear when we're teenagers have an incredibly emotional and even psychological impact upon us. So for me, one of the biggest impacts was, of course, King Crimson. I mean, there were lots of other albums that I heard in my teens, but I would say that it was King Crimson that was the biggest impact. And kind of back in the 90s, I think it was, early 90s, King Crimson brought out a box set. It was their first proper box set. It was four CDs.
Yeah, I had
and at the time, four CDs seemed like, wow, that's such a lot of CDs, so that was like, I don't know, 1991 or something. Maybe it was a year or two either side. I haven't got it in front of me. And I remember thinking, wouldn't it be great if there was a King Crimson fanzine, because there didn't seem to be. So I thought I'd create one, and I'd got access to through the work I did, I had access to a kind of a desktop publishing computer at the time, and I wrote to Robert Fripp, asking him for an interview for my new fanzine, which was called Crimhead.
There you go.
And well, to move it forward a bit, Crimhead never got published, but Robert declined to do an interview. But fast forward a few years later, I was in London. I live in Newcastle. Well, actually, I live in Whitby, which is near Newcastle on the
East
Coast.
Did you say you lived in
Whitby?
Oh, okay. Because my daughter went to school. My daughter went to school in Newcastle.
Beautiful. All right. Okay. Yeah. So I'm like 10 miles on the coast from Newcastle, and I'd gone down to London. There was a series of events celebrating the the 30th anniversary of In the Court of the Crimson King, and Robert Fripp was doing a talk. And he in a bookshop in London called Borders, which was an American
Sure, yeah, we had American.
Yeah, of course. And it was a great bookshop. Anyway, at the end of it, I sort of met Robert a few times subsequently, and so at the end of it, he sort of, you know, I went over, and he the pair of us went to a table on our own and had a bit of a catch up and a chat. And I'd said to him that I was thinking about writing a book about King Crimson, because there was a book about Robert Fripp and King Crimson by Eric Tam. And it was a great book.
Yeah, I had that book.
But it didn't count for me as a nerdy fan. It didn't have enough detail in it.
Oh.
And Robert said, well, there's two things to bear in mind if you're going to write a book. One is nobody's going to want to publish it. And the second thing is, you know, you're on your own. I won't be taking part in it. And I went, well, no, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. And so that was that. So I wrote up a pitch, and there was a publisher in London called Helter Skelter. Mm-hmm. And they said yes.
So that was the 2001 edition, right?
So this would be about 1998 or 1997, I think, maybe when we were having the chat in London, Robert and I. So that was the original publisher, yes.
And then they were great. And then the 2019 book, which is the version I have, significantly different are those two books in terms of, this book is about 600 pages. And I have to say one of my favorite portions of this book, and there are many, is it ends with probably a 130 page gigography, where pretty much it's memories of, I don't know if they're all the gigs or many of those gigs. So what were the differences between the two books?
Well, the original book was kind of, I think in total, I can't remember the word counts now, but in total it was about a couple of hundred pages. Whereas this kind of 50th anniversary edition of the book is a significantly expanded.
It's 600 plus.
Yeah, and the main reason was, of course, at the time when I was doing the first edition of the book, you know, I talked to pretty much everybody in the band in the different lineups.
Right.
I think the only person who I did talk to, but he declined to go on the record, was Boz Burrell, the bass player with the band during the Islands period. But everybody else kind of spoke to me. And, of course, in the intervening years, you know, the landscape changed quite a bit. King Crimson were releasing you know, these really big archive box sets. They were releasing kind of collector club things. So there was more and more material becoming available.
Right.
That was available the first time around. And also people's perspective change, Sal. You know, so you and I are not the same people we were when we were 20. You know, we have different views, different perspectives. Even, you know, we come to change our minds, don't we, about so many things. And what was useful, I think, was going back to interview some of the same people I'd interviewed first time around, but with a 20-year gap. And a different, and they all have different sort of feelings and different views. Maybe they've cooled to something that they were initially quite enthusiastic about, et cetera, et cetera. So I managed to get those kinds of narrative differences into the piece. I also, because the original book ends in 2000-ish, I think. Well, of course, King Crimson kind of carried on, carried on until 2003, and then it stopped for a while, and then it started up again in 2008, right. And then it stopped a while, and then it started
Seven-headed beast you had there, you know, 2014. Yeah, so I have to say that the book, you know, for its length, it's eminently readable, and it pretty much, if you like King Crimson or anything about progressive rock and music, it's in there. Like you say, all these musicians are have their say, and you also sort of go off into the important side projects that these musicians also do. Yeah. I just wanted to kind of, for folks who maybe still need to be a little convinced about King Crimson, but I wanted to really start with a little bit about Rob, you know, tell us a little bit about Robert, his childhood, you know, sort of his Welsh background. He almost became a real estate agent like his dad, I understand. And, you know, his first primary interest in guitar, which began around, I guess, the age of 11 and with Scotty Moore and those kinds of influences.
Yeah, I think Robert's upbringing, I think probably contributed something to his pretty disciplined approach. He was always, as a youngster even, he was always pretty, he could dedicate himself to the thing. He understood that if he put the hard yards in, something might happen. And you know, you kind of, any musician will tell you that you know, goes on to have a career that spans over 50 years. You do need a bit of luck as well. Mm-hmm. But King Crimson in the early days, you know, kind of pretty much created its own look. It was when, by the time Robert left, you know, as you say, he was going to become he was at college to study real estate, and then he decided to give it up and become a professional musician, which was a huge event in his life. He then, sort of set about, like all musicians do, you know, living in poverty and and kind of, you know, not getting any gigs, or the gigs he got were useless, and poorly paid, etc. So, it's the old cliche, paying your dues, you know.
Right.
Robert sort of paid his dues for a couple of years in pretty grim circumstances.
So playing like a lot of cocktail jazz, and you know, which was a surprise to me.
They were playing anything they could play. I mean, right. They were just, you know. This was with the Giles brothers,
right.
Michael and Peter Giles. What happens amazingly is that King Crimson just were in the right place at the right time. And that's what I was saying about a bit of luck. I suspect Robert wouldn't say that it was luck. I think Robert would attribute King Crimson's kind of sudden success to a sort of a meeting point of different events that you know, kind of pull each other to that moment.
Well, you also say in the book, like a lot of his early associations, these folks ended up being filtered into the band. For instance, he met Greg Lake and John Wetton in college, Gordon Haskell before that. So,
they're all friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the basis for most of the early bands certainly in the 70s. They're all people he went to school with or knew through. You know, Andy McCulloch, who plays drums on the third King Crimson album, Lizard. He was another Bournemouth boy. You know, you come from that part of the world. And of course, Robert had played as a young man. A sort of 15, 16 year old. It was well known on the local music circuit in that part of the country, in the southwest. So, so Robert was really just pulling in all the available resources that he knew of, you know, to make things happen.
So how did we get from, let's talk a little bit how he gets from Giles and Fripp to the classic 68 formation of the band.
And, well, he gets there because, essentially, the quick version is Peter Giles leaves. They get Greg Lake in. Greg Lake, of course, wasn't a bass player. Greg Lake was a guitarist. But the deal was that Greg Lake came in to play bass. And that lineup kind of coalesced very quickly. The key factor in that lineup is probably Ian MacDonald.
Definitely, yes.
Who comes in via contacts with Judy Dybel, who had responded to an advert, Giles and Fripp connection there, and indeed recorded, I think, an early version of I Talk to the Wind.
Right, that's a great version. So this 68 band just kind of bursts on the scene. I mean, it had sort of a proto metal energy with kind of mixed with a free jazz sensibility. They went pretty quick from formation to kind of stardom. So if you could tell us a little bit about that. And then the first album, which I still believe is their best selling album, and which was self-produced, correct? What was the story of that?
Well, in 69, January 69, the band properly form, and it's kind of January 69, they find somewhere to rehearse, they've secured financial backing, and this is important. Ian MacDonald's uncle was a business person, and he gave them a legally drawn up loan, and that loan, that sum of money, put everybody on a wage. So that meant they didn't have to work, you know, during the day doing something else. They drew a weekly wage and spent their entire time practicing and working and developing material. They also had, with that money, bought pretty good gear.
Like the Mellotron. Yes.
Yeah, which wasn't cheap. Even back then. I mean, they're horrendously expensive now, but even back then they were horrendously expensive. There weren't many people owned Mellotrons. That kind of musical polish, there weren't many bands on the scene at the time. You've got to remember, this is like kind of the emergent sort of prog thing. It's coming out of blues. It's coming out of sort of heavy rock. King Crimson are doing something different. They're not doing blues. They're not doing straightforward heavy rock. They're not doing songs that sort of have a sort of a 12 bar-y kind of vibe and sort of with lyrics that say, you know, baby, I love you or whatever, you know, there's a kind of different vibe going on, which is sort of more mystical, and it's got all those different.
And that was a product of Sinfield, right? Peter Sinfield.
Yeah. Pete Sinfield as the lyricist was a significant factor in the band's evolution. And that shouldn't be underestimated. But I think by the time they get to play live, there's an amazing sort of word of mouth around London And London's obviously important because that's where the music industry is based.
Yeah. And a very small scene, you know, like Hendrix comes in one day, gets off a plane, goes to a club, and all of a sudden the Beatles are fans.
Yeah.
Similarly.
And that's very much the case for Crimson, because for two reasons. One is their musicality, their chops, is, you know, people are saying, who are these people? You know, because nobody knows who they are because they're not on the scene. They're not from the scene. They come into the scene. Mm-hmm. And that word of mouth spreads like, it's sort of a bit like Hendrix did, as you just said. I think, you know, in March, so we started in January, we're now in March, April, May. Mm-hmm. They've not only been offered a record deal two or three times,
right?
Which they turned down. They're playing, you know, lots of gigs and going down well. There's a lot of buzz about them in the press. They play at Hyde Park, supporting the Rolling Stones, one of the five or six acts on that.
And blowing away Blind Faith, I would assume, right? Correctly.
According to many eyewitnesses, sort of, you know, kind of blowing away a lot of the competition on the day. When it comes to their recording their debut album, they initially, one of the first record companies to offer them a gig, offer them a deal, was owned by the Moody Blues. It was owned by, it was Threshold Records.
Right.
And although King Crimson declined that offer, they had an association with the Moody Blues producer, Tony Clark. And, you know, they did a couple of sessions with Tony Clark, and Tony Clark's approach, they decided they didn't want to work with Tony Clark. And so
Has that ever been released? Has any of that stuff, the Tony Clark stuff, been released?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think there's a track. I haven't got it in front of me, but there's a couple of tracks where on the big 1969 box set, which would cover that. Right. Then just to cap that one, you know, they're young men still. I mean, they're in their early 20s, and they decide to sack or part company with a producer who'd had huge hits with the Moody Blues, who was, you know, very commercially orientated. And I think it takes quite a lot of balls to do that. Mm-hmm. But they had a real firm belief in their own abilities. And so they produced that album. And when it came out, it sold incredibly well. They were lucky because their managers, David Entwoven and John Gaydon, who are two names that should also be remembered in the King Crimson story, because without them, basically everybody who put money into King Crimson got their money back. So Ian MacDonald's uncle got his money back. David Entwoven, who mortgaged his house to pay for the recording sessions, he got his money back.
Right.
Well, basically the financial explosion of the debut album really set up, helped stabilize a lot of what was going on in Island Records, for example. Mm-hmm. And the clever thing is that they didn't sign a contract to Island Records. Mm-hmm. They leased the album to Island Records.
It was very forward thinking.
Not many people are doing that.
Unfortunately, this band didn't last long. America kind of tore it apart, right? The first tour, and then MacDonald and Giles go off on their own. And then it's kind of an interesting, it would have been an interesting alternative history, but I understand that Fripp himself offered to leave the band for the band to continue. So if you could tell us a little bit about that, how they sort of came apart and then moved into the next era of King Crimson, which was, let's say, the three albums, Poseidon, Lizards, and Islands, which, you know, after the follow-up of that huge debut, maybe a little underwhelming to some, But now with the latter day, this whole Seven Headed Beast tour, those albums are sort of coming to the fore again. I know it's a pretty loaded question, but you could just.
Well, I mean, as you've outlined it there, that's, you know, exactly what happened. It took, I think we have to try and put ourselves in the mind of what happens when a band's on tour, and various things happen. You know, for one thing, Michael Giles and Ian MacDonald were just, you know, homesick, lovesick, kind of feeling isolated, and not enjoying touring. And that's kind of what forces the split in the band. Robert, as you indicate, did offer to leave, but it wouldn't have made any difference. In the aftermath, the really amazing thing is that it just didn't fall apart completely. Right. The amazing thing is that Robert, I think the danger is that sometimes when talking about King Crimson, the danger is we ascribe everything that happens to Robert Fripp.
Right.
And there is some truth in that, obviously, but and I think in this instance, it's definitely King Crimson exists because of Robert Fripp's force of will. The band is effectively ripped apart, and yet he keeps it going. Him and Sinfield keep it going, but primarily it's Robert Fripp that keeps it going from a musical point of view, because Peter wasn't a composer. The three albums that follow, as you indicate, I mean, they're three stylistically very different albums, from one another. But they all contain something that sounds like King Crimson.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, the jazz influence is coming in with Keith Tippett, and then this kind of, you know, the different vocal qualities of Gordon Haskell and obviously Boz. But then after that trio of albums comes really the next great period, maybe the greatest period in the minds of a lot of folks, which was the quintet, then quartet with Bruford, Cross, Wenton, Muir, and Robert. So, and that's the first band that you actually were exposed to in a live situation, correct? Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that band and why it's so influential.
In 1972, I remember I'd missed King Crimson when they'd come to Newcastle in 1971. I'd just missed them. I don't know how, but I did. And despite being a fan of the band. So in 1972, in the summer of 1972, there was a live album released called Earthbound, which was sonically very challenging, but contained some great performances. It must be said. And then there was an announcement that Bill Bruford from Yes had joined, et cetera, et cetera. And this new band, when it came together, it was like, whoa, this is something new and different. And just how new and different it was astonishing. I went to a gig in the November of 72, and I had heard nothing like it. The gig, you have to remember, gigs at the time, they were using long, long sections of improvisation. Mm-hmm. And these were very dynamic improvisations. It wasn't vamping on a couple of blues chords or a couple of chords of whatever hue. They were more like contemporary classical pieces. Because they were very angular and dissonant, and then they would rock out for a bit, and then it would change direction. And the hard thing that people like me at the time, I was like 15 or something at the time, the hard thing I had believing was that it was improvised. I had no idea that it was improvised. I thought it was a composition, you know. Of course, these things were blended with compositions. So when Larkstone and Aspic came out, it was great hearing it, because you thought, oh, that's what that piece was, you know. The other thing it's quick to say is Jamie Muir on stage was an amazing energy.
Right.
He came from the avant-garde jazz tradition, free improv tradition in the UK. And so he was a very liberating kind of force. Anything was possible. And of course, and he was visually very, very dramatic to look at. He looked
very physical. And then he went off to the monastery after his time in Crimson.
But that's this right. Sorry, go on.
No, but this particular version, again, as challenging as it was, and let's say it got to be dissonant and very avant-garde, then it would contrast with vocal tunes like Book of Saturday and, even instrumentals like the improvisation on Trio on Starless, which were, these moments of chaos and musical violence and then sort of sereneness and beauty.
Yeah. I mean, that you've described it perfectly. It was a music that covered a lot of ground. It managed to kind of move in a lot of directions, but it did so convincingly. It wasn't like piecemeal. It wasn't like a bit of this and a bit of that. Each sort of avenue they explored seemed to be pretty thought through, and it flowed beautifully. There's some lovely contrast, but there was also a lot of unanimity in the aim. And I think for me, I saw that band a couple of times, on tour, and they were an astonishing band. They remain my favorite King Crimson band.
Yeah. A lot of people.
Whilst there are, I saw the band many, many more times since, but that period was incredibly influencing on me.
And then I think very influencing now was the Trio album, which was the Red album, which probably has the best power trio song of all time, which is the title track. Then at this time is when Fripp, around this era is when Fripp, I should note that although we are audio, you're wearing another Green World t-shirt, so this is the time, this is when he starts to collaborate with Brian on Frippertronics, and if you tell us a little about that, and then onto his break.
The first time I ever heard Fripp and Eno, of course, was at that gig in 1972, because they were playing the No Pussyfooting album. There was only one side of No Pussyfooting recorded. That was the Heavenly Music Corporation, which Fripp and Eno had done in the summer. In 72, when by the time I saw them on tour, it was being used as walk-on music. We knew about it because it was written about in the music press that Robert Fripp was recording an album with Brian Eno. And for me, that was great because I loved Roxy music. I was a huge fan of Roxy music at the time. So, what's not to like? By the time you get to Red, I think there's a lot of, we were talking about Giles and MacDonald having a, kind of as an existential crisis on tour. And I think, when you think about it, Robert had been kind of from 69 all the way through to 74. Robert had pretty much non-stop been either on the road or running a band or trying to put a band together. And I think, he felt that he's written about this extensively, of course. Something else was possible. He just found the madness of the rock and roll industry eventually just sort of too wearing.
Right.
He wanted to find he was also searching for a kind of a spiritual outlet, and he found it in the shape of the writings of J.G. Bennett. And that's what finally prompted his dissolution of King Crimson. Initially, it was going to be a sabbatical. They were going to take a year out, but that idea didn't fly. Management, there was another version which said that Ian MacDonald, who guests on the album, would come back into the band. John Wetton was very keen on that idea, and Bill Bruford was as well. But Robert didn't want to do that, but was said at the time, well, you guys can be King Crimson. And in the end, nobody wanted to do it without Robert.
Right.
And so by the time Red is released, King Crimson are no more.
Well, then he after a short break, I just wanted to ask you if we could reconnect. We're going to end in about 4 minutes, and if we can do it again, get a few more minutes. Okay, great. So then I don't have to rush you through, you know. So then we come to 1977 when he starts collaborating, the famous collaboration with Bowie, Heroes. Around that same time, he did the album, I believe, with Dal Hall, right? Sacred Songs? Yeah.
Sacred Songs. Yeah.
And then that leading into his return with the solo album Exposure and his time in New York. And so...
Yeah, New York was really important for Robert. I mean, it was a million miles away, not literally, of course. It was so far removed from the UK music industry. It had and it had a completely different vibe. Robert has described New York as a place where anything was possible, and he kind of enjoyed that sort of air. Excuse me, I've got a terrible cough. You'll have to do some editing, I think. and the New York period, where he's working with, as you say, Deborah Harry, Chris Stein. He's working on all sorts of things, doing all kinds of small gigs, and eventually you get to it to his album Exposure. He's also worked with Peter Gabriel. Let's not forget David Bowie, of course. So it's an incredibly fertile period, and one which I think Robert, to this day, looks back on with a lot of affection, as he should do. It was, everybody sort of thinks, you know, King Crimson is the high point for Robert, but it's probably more like that period is the high point for Robert, I would argue.
Well, we saw him at the Kitchen, you know, doing his Frippertronics at the Kitchen, and, you know, we're also... very much like the album God Save the Queen with the disco Frippertronics side, which was Under Heavy Manner.
Yeah, that's a great album. I love that. That's a great period. I love all the Frippertronics. I never saw it live. But I've listened to hours and hours of it when I've been helping with the box sets that they were doing. But
now all guitarists like myself who have a looping system can pretend to be Robert Fripp for a second. His image as a serious guy, although he does have this really great sense of humor, and then Adrian Belew, who can play the virtuoso 1 second and the clown another second. So I would assume there, you know, that became maybe more of a point of conflict later on.
I think the second album famously is the album Beat. The second album is where they famously broke up, actually. Mm-hmm. And in normal circumstances, you know, the band, that would have been it.
Right.
But they kept going, I think, largely because, you know, they weren't young kids anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They were mature adults who realized that they had to put their certain feelings, their differences to one side. And I think there's a definite tension between Adrian's vision as a songwriter and Fripp's view as a composer. The magic happens, it's when those two worlds come together.
Right.
And the sparks, if there are points of conflict, they kind of help move the thing along. But of course, you know, we all know the phrase, "Oh, conflict's good for a band," but you can only get along so far with that, and eventually starts to gum up the works. So King Crimson ends in 1984, and Bill Bruford's quoted as saying, you know, you never knew if King Crimson was going to be there when you came down in the hotel for breakfast. You know, was I going to be a band? Was I not going to be a band? And there's a bit of truth in that for sure.
So
but
Yeah, but then he goes off, and he goes off again into a solo sphere, right, with soundscapes, which is around 84, I believe, right? Which and what to you? To me, I've seen like the Frippertronics, you know, in the earlier stuff, and then the soundscapes, and the you know, the soundscapes is a much more minimal experience. It's kind of like almost music minus one Frippertronics in a way to me. I mean, I don't know what you're, you know, he's not ripping over it.
I saw, I never saw the Frippertronics, as I said earlier, but, and I wish I had. but I have seen a fair few soundscape performances. And for me, the soundscape performances, if the Frippertronics are sort of minimalist in nature, as you rightly describe them, then soundscapes are maximalist in nature. Soundscapes are huge, vast, harmonic canvas in which, you know, Robert goes into some extraordinary areas. And I find, I think some of it can be intimidating. And there's different areas of soundscapes. There are sort of some periods where Robert insists on using a kind of a thing that sounds a bit like a DX7, kind of Fender Rhodes tone, a time piano tone, which isn't kind of a bit jarring, especially when it's detuned a little bit, which Robert likes to do. It's almost like vibes, but you know, vibraphone, but not quite in tune sometimes. And then, of course, there's the other sort of aspect of soundscapes, which is these huge orchestral swells of which sound like the end of the world coming. You know, if you're in the middle of that and you're in the room when that's kind of happening, it's really profound stuff. It's the journey of the soul into the long dark night. But maybe not as many laughs, you know.
Yeah. In 94, I guess against all odds, that initial quartet comes back together with Trey and Pat. So then there's a sixth person. That's the band. And that band had a pretty long run, correct?
Yeah, the bit before the double trio, as it would be come to be known, Robert records an album with David Sylvian called The First Day, and they form a little band, and that includes Trey Gunn. Trey Gunn, for my money, is one of the is a really important character in the latter King Crimson story. At the time, Trey Gunn was completely underappreciated. Nobody had a clue what he was doing. He wasn't helped by some frankly poor live mixing where you couldn't hear him on stage. And so a lot of fans were saying, well, I can hear what Tony Levin's doing, but what's that other guy with the stick doing? and I think it took a while really for Trey to be heard as a seriously good musical presence within King Crimson. You're right, the band did have a reasonable run from 94 to 97.
Oh, okay.
In 1997 that original lineup fell apart because of Fripp and Bruford falling out again, as they did in 84. That tension was left unresolved.
There was a thing that
Pat Mastrolotto, who's the other drummer who comes alongside Bill Bruford, Pat Mastrolotto, for my money, is whereas Michael Giles is obviously recognised as a kind of an incredible drummer within King Crimson, and Bill Bruford is, of course. I really rate Pat Mastrolotto as well, although he comes from a very different tradition, and I think he's more rock orientated. But I think what Pat Mastrolotto and Trey Gunn together bring is a phenomenal musicality that's quite different from Fripp and Ballou. And when you can hear it really well, I think on the album they did in 2000 called the When They Were Back as a Quartet. On the album The Construction of Light, which overall is a bit of a mixed botch of an album. The best track for me is the bonus track, which is credited to Project X, but that's really. That's really Trey Gunn and Pat Mastelotto kind of guiding the shape of that track. And well, for me, that's some of the most exciting music that era produced.
Well, let's take it to the end here, possibly of King Crimson, the Seven-Headed Beast, which came together in about that was from about 2014 to 21. Which was a band that revisited a lot of what we mentioned, the second through fifth album, I guess. And then Robert's, his COVID fame, Robert and Toya's, Sunday brunch videos. And, is there going to be more King Crimson? But, you know, so let's just take that final chapter and let's have your thoughts on where they go from here. If they go anywhere.
If you've been a fan of King Crimson for as long as probably you and I have, we probably know that never is not the right word to use. So will there be another King Crimson album again? Who can say? It seems unlikely, but don't say never. You know, I think at this day and age, at this time in people's lives, Tony Levin's just recently celebrated, was it his 78th birthday?
He lives right here. I live right near him. He plays all the time here in Woodstock. I'm in Woodstock.
I've been up there a few years ago. I was around that area.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely part of the world. And we, you know, whether or not there's the logistics for getting a band like King Crimson back together again. It feels unlikely, but, you know, I wouldn't rule it out. You know, remember in 1974, Robert said King Crimson is over and you know, forever. It has ceased to exist. It'll never come back. And then, you know, lo and behold, it pops up. So you can never say never.
Right.
But that period from 2014 through, I saw that band a lot.
Yeah, me too.
And... And I thought their performances, the level at which they were working, was phenomenal. And I also saw the effect it had on people as well. I spent a lot of my time in the audience part of the auditorium, and I, you know, moving around. And the effect, as I say, you know, when those opening chords of Starless, which hadn't been played for 40 years, you know, it's the first time I remember that vividly, hearing that for the first time, you know, all the hairs standing on end.
Yeah.
And the effect it had on people was astonishing. There are some who say, you know, kind of, oh, you know, why do you need three drummers? It's a gimmick and so on. But I found the three drummer thing was, you know, I was initially thought, three drummers? That seems a bit excessive, but it kind of worked.
It totally worked.
And it refocused, it got people thinking about the band in a completely different way. And I thought that aspect of it is important because it shakes people up a bit and it makes them think, oh, okay, this isn't the same old, this is something different.
Well, there is a lot, you know, there's so much music to enjoy with King Crimson. And I have to say again that your book is highly recommended. It's in the court of King Crimson, an observation over 50 years. And thanks for joining us, Sid Smith. And we'll be listening and hoping you write some more great stuff about both Crimson and Prague music.